Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. I'm Pip Adam, and this is episode 46, but it's also, there's all the numbers are happening now, it's also the second in our Oryx and Crake series. So for four episodes we are going to be exploring one book. We're looking at Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake book. It's a novel. It's really good. So this week, in this episode, I speak with Bill Nelson, who is a Wellington poet, and we talk about the place of memory and flashback in Oryx and Crake. And we also talk a little bit about how Snowman or Jimmy is possibly the worst last man and why that makes this such a compelling book and makes him such a perfect choice as the main character and our guide through this post-apocalyptic version of our planet. I hope you enjoy this. Again, if you haven't read the book and you want to, be a little bit careful because there are spoilers, but if you haven't read the book and are happy with spoilers, it's not a prerequisite. You will be able to understand what we talk about whether you've read the book or not. We are on a few social media outlets. If you have listened to the last one and want to talk a little bit about it, or if you want to leave a comment at our WordPress site, it's betterred.wordpress.com, and that's betterrednz, so betterrednz.wordpress.com, and you can leave a comment there. We're also on Facebook, and we're also on Twitter. Wow. Anyway, I hope that you really enjoy this. I really enjoyed talking to Bill, and it was wonderful to chat with him. And yes, thank you.
Flotsam. On the white beach, ground up coral and broken bones, a group of children are walking. They must have been swimming. They're still wet and glistening. They should be more careful. Who knows what may infest the lagoon? But they're unwary, unlike Snowman, who won't dip a toe in there even at night when the sun can't get at him. Revision, especially at night. He watches them with envy, or is it nostalgia? It can't be that. He never swam in the sea as a child, never ran around on the beach without any clothes on. The children scan the terrain, stoop, pick up flotsam, then they deliberate among themselves, keeping some items, discarding others. Their treasures go into a torn sack. Sooner or later, he can count on it, they'll seek him out where he sits wrapped in his decaying sheet, hugging his shins and sucking on his mango, in under the shade of the trees because of the punishing sun. For the children, thick-skinned, resistant to ultraviolet, he's a creature of dimness, of the dusk. Here they come now. Snowman, oh snowman, they chant in their sing-song way. They never stand too close to him. Is that from respect, as he'd like to think, or because he stinks? He does stink. He knows that well enough. He's rank, he's gamey, he reeks like a walrus. Oily, salty, fishy. Not that he's ever smelled such a beast, but he's seen pictures. Opening up their sack, the children chorus, oh snowman, what have we found? They lift out the objects, hold them up as if offering them for sale. A hubcap, a piano key, a chunk of pale green pop bottle smoothed by the ocean. A plastic Bliss Plus container, empty. A chicken nobs bucket o' nubbins, ditto. A computer mouse or the busted remains of one with a long wiry tail. Snowman feels like weeping. What can he tell them? There's no way of explaining to them what these curious items are or were, but surely they've guessed what he'll say because it's always the same. These are things from before. He keeps his voice kindly but remote, a cross between pedagogue, soothsayer, and benevolent uncle. That should be his tone.
Okay, so hello, Bill. How are you?
Good, thank you.
That's very good. Thanks for coming round and talking about this book. So the bit that I got you to read out is the start of the second chapter, and it talks a little bit about sort of the idea of the past and how the past sort of infects the sort of present narrative, which is kind of how we stumble our way through the book. And I was just wondering, like, there seem to be several modes that the protagonist Snowman is in. He's in the present, sort of dealing with this post-apocalyptic world. Then there seems to be this voice that takes him back to the past. So there's sort of like flashback in here as well, like past being shown very much as memory. I mean, memory being shown very much as sort of like, you know, unpacking in front of us. I just wondered, do you want to talk a little bit about that? Or how you found it when you read the book?
Yeah, because it's actually one of the things that struck me the most when I read it the second time. So yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to read it twice,
because
don't normally read novels twice. So, yeah, it was really good, actually. Yeah, so that was the thing that struck me the most. I was reading, actually, this is like 95% flashback, this novel. Like, very little actually happens in the present.
Mm.
And I was like, and that kind of made me think, why had Atwood done that? Yeah, and she actually talks about it directly in some places in the book. Like, there's one bit where he's having like a dream, and it's like a kind of a nightmarish dream, but then a sound, you know, that, you know, you have those dreams, you can hear a sound in the background, and it kind of infects the dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like, yeah, the present kind of infects his past recollection directly, and she even says, like, the present's bad enough without the past getting mixed into it. And I was like, oh, that seems like the, like, blurb for the novel a little bit.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting. Obviously something that's happening deliberately in the novel. And I also got to a point about probably three quarters of the way through where I wondered whether he was an unreliable narrator and he was actually like making up a lot of his backstory.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seemed quite different from the way it was described as well. It was quite different from the present. Like, the present is obviously ultra realist and kind of quite yeah, it seems like very real, but the way he describes the time before the apocalypse or whatever is almost like cartoonish, I found, in some things, like the animals and lots of the stuff that's happening. It's like, is this actually him just making stuff up about his own history? I don't think it is that. Like, I kind of like was wondering that, but it didn't seem to quite pan out that way. But yeah, I thought that was like an interesting thing. Maybe it's partially he makes up some of it or something, I don't know. But
because yeah. that is quite a mind-blowing thought. I have never thought of that reading, but I really like it. Because I sort of, you know, like, we meet Snowman, like, especially in that bit that you've begun to read. I think this is the first time that we meet him in storytelling mode, which is another mode that he's in, where he's making this mythology and history for the genetically engineered humans, the Krakers, the children of Krake. You know, and I think that I think it's a really interesting idea, and also that idea of you know, the way he is so centered in the apocalypse. You know, it is quite interesting to sort of think that, you know, all he has time to do is think about the past, and I'm sure it would become warped, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It's an interesting idea that, like, you would, like, the world would, like, be destroyed, and all you could do was reminisce. Like, that's like I reckon that's the really different thing about this book, is that it's like, it's not about, like, he's not really even trying to survive or trying to, like, find other people or anything. He's just, like, sits around reminiscing about what his life and how screwed up it was, I think. Which is, like, you know, possibly the worst person you could have is the last person on earth. Like, that this person, he should be going and doing stuff and trying to, like, forge a new society or something, but yeah, it's like really interesting. He just sits around and kind of thinks about how messed up his life was.
and like that weird thing where I guess part of it's kind of like, what an odd situation to be in, to sort of see yourself almost, you know, like, you were, is that word implicit? Complicit. You were almost complicit in the end of the world. And yeah. Now you get to sit around and think about it. And
yeah.
There's also that dual narrative that he's managing, you know, the narrative of what he sees as the truth as it happened, but then also the narrative that he's managing around the Krakers, you know, the narrative around, you know, like, just this wild mythology about, you know, even, it is a really interesting sort of idea for a book. Like, narratively it works really well, doesn't it? Because we, like, Daniel was talking about it the other day, you know, like, what we get is we get to see someone working, you know, the mystery of the novel is how we got here, you know, so it works narratively really well. But I really like that idea of thinking about him being this way, because you would think it would be a temptation. You would think, in a lonely time, like, there's a part later on where he talks about talking to himself and how he just, what does he say? He feels the need to hear a human voice, a fully human voice like his own. And this weird thing where he's surrounded by these people that he's responsible for, or these beings that he's responsible for, that look like him, speak like him, well, don't look exactly like him, but, you know, are there. But in reality, you know, what he's hearkening back to is his friends and, you know, the way that Earth used to be.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the stories that he tells the Krakers are really interesting, I think, because it reveals so much about him, and I guess, like, by association, that society that he came from, that it's like he just like tells them these stories kind of for his own for his own ends. Like, it's no, he has no purpose for them other than to sort of keep them happy and make sure they bring him fish and that kind of thing.
That's what I
think. He's like he's learned nothing from this whole experience.
Because that kind of feels like the exemplar of the stories, isn't it? It's kind of like, I am starving. Oh, I think that Crake, you know, this godhead Crake and this godhead Oryx, you know, they need you to bring me a fish, you know, like, I need a fish, you know, and oh my goodness, you can fish, I cannot, you know. And just this, I think, this wonderful power of the story and the power he holds over them, and that he's explaining their past to them and their present to them, which is a terrifying kind of, you know, exercise in almost complete propaganda or something.
Yeah
it's such a weird thing.
Yeah, that's right, he's totally a product of that world that he's come from, and he seems like he's just in limbo, I guess, waiting for something to happen.
Yeah When did you first read the book?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. Must have been at least 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of the books I buy, I think I found it in a book fair.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I was like, I haven't read a Margaret Atwood book before, so yeah, that's where I picked it up, I think. It was a little while ago, and then I read it again a few weeks ago, which is really good. It's amazing how, like, a lot of it is, a lot of it is so vivid, the way that she writes about it, and, like, almost like little catchphrases, like all the propaganda stuff from the compounds and all the marketing, all that stuff, like, you know, it is all instantly recognizable, because it's, yeah, quite clever how she's kind of, like, picked out, I guess, that kind of absurd, it's almost like cartoonish language and stuff from that times, like that. And I think it's kind of characterized as well by the way that Jimmy goes to some kind of lesser university, which is a humanities university.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like they've lost the ability to, like, come up with good names for things as well. Like, all the names for stuff are really lame. It's like, yeah, so they don't care about language or anything anymore. So it's like, and it's yeah, and I think she touches on that as well when she talks about storytelling and that, how it's like, it's obviously important for him, but everyone else in the compounds didn't really care about this stuff. Mm. It was all hard science and, you know, all looking towards the future and how they could better themselves.
And that awesome thing where, like, the most use that his humanities degree can be is writing copy for, you know what I mean, like coming up with names for products, you know, and the dreadful, those... Because it's the type of medication that he ends up working on, isn't it? You know, like, it's a medication that will make people happy and, ends up not so happy. But, and there's also that great, you know, like, his superpower does seem to be language, you know, because there's also that, that great line, and, well, I don't know what you'd call it, but it's like this wonderful thing that he does where he's remembered amazing words, you know, like words from Shakespeare and stuff like that. And that's part of some of his, I don't know, his entertainment, I guess, or his touchstone to who he was or something, as he walks around, you know, in this dreadful, you know, place.
Yeah.
Part of me was wondering, I've got this, someone once told me this idea, and I don't know if it's true, but it I think there's one reading of this where it is true, where, you know, like, all writing is about writing, you know what I mean? Like, all writing is about the importance of story. And I guess that in some ways, this piecing together of the past and this piecing together of the control that he's holding over the other people, it is kind of interesting in that way.
Yeah, and it's almost like, it seems like a manifesto for flashback in some ways. It's like, or like, I guess, history, and that, but, you know, the society they had was all about future, you know, moving forward, not never looking back sort of thing. And it seems like it's a real critique of that. I mean, you could argue, like, Jimmy/Snowman, like, goes too far the other way, where he's just, like, trapped in the past, but it's like, it seems like, you know, it's a bit of a like trying to, I guess, sort of, you know, talk about, you know, the importance of doing that, of like looking back sometimes. And I guess that's partly what storytelling is, you know. Mm. It's like telling a story that's usually already happened. So yeah, I think it is kind of touching on that in quite a crucial sort of way, and that kind of mixed up in that, the politics of like science and futurism, I don't know, I think it's like humanism or whatever, when people always, you know, we can, humans are free to kind of do what they want and construct their own sort of destiny sort of thing, and it's just, you know, it'll be okay because we know what we're doing sort of thing. And I think it's definitely kind of a bit of a critique of that kind of stuff. I totally agree that if any kind of prose isn't like talking about storytelling in some way, then it's not really adding much to the form, I suppose. So yeah, even if it's quite a subtle way, I think it has to deal with storytelling in some way.
Yeah.
But yeah, Margaret Atwood seems to do it quite directly, and she even mentions it in like several places in several different ways. So.
Because I guess the other thing that I was just thinking about that thing you were saying, like, I mean, you know, like, the constant looking forward, the constant, you know, not checking of, you know, not checking. I'm always interested in that idea of, you know, if we can do it, does that mean we should do it kind of thing? And there's one character in the past who is Jimmy's mother, Snowman's mother, and she comes out very badly, you know, like, there's this group of resistance. There is a resistance to this idea, you know, and it's really interesting watching how she plays out in it, and his, you know, a lot of the story of the past is possibly, you know, because his mother has joined the resistance, you know, he's often interviewed by the police, and, you know, like, there's this interesting kind of, I just think it's really, it's great because it's questioned in the past as well as being questioned in the future, kind of, in the present as well, eh?
Yeah, although I found them really opaque, the kind of resistance thing, like, yeah, she's a part of the resistance, but then she just disappears, and you don't really learn anything about, she occasionally appears on the news, but you don't really learn anything about what she does or what they're trying to do. Like, it's really remote from him. Like, he obviously has very little contact with it. So it seems like there is some kind of resistance, but it's almost, in his world anyway, it's quite ineffective and basically might as well not exist, you know? Like, he's only aware of it because of his mother, really. So, yeah, it's quite interesting that you'd choose to have a resistance. And it's obviously got this kind of class society with, like, the wealthy, intelligent people living in these compounds, and then everyone else living in the, what's it called, the plebe lands?
I think, yeah, the plebe lands, yeah.
Yeah, another weird name for stuff. But, yeah, it's like this kind of class thing, but then you never really see the other class. It's all centred around the stuff he was involved in.
And I think
it's an interesting decision, I reckon. She could have easily had a whole series of chapters set in the plebe lands with his mother and all kinds of stuff, you know, but just decided not to do that.
Because that's what I think is really interesting about that reading you posited right at the start. You know, like, I mean, you know, maybe there is some, you know, that thing, maybe the reason it's opaque is because the idea that he didn't join or he didn't help or he actively hindered, you know, and now he's here, you know, like, I mean, I just think you're so right. I think that it's a really good decision because it's a totally different book with that in there, isn't it? Like, you know, it's a, you know, like, it almost feels like we're on the side of, well, not on the side, like, I guess we are looking and thinking, oh no, that's not a good idea. But there's something appealing about Craik, and there's something appealing, like, this is the other thing that I always find weird is whenever I talk about this book, I talk very little about Craik, and yet, you know, yet, man, you know, like, I just think he's such an interesting character, eh?
Yeah, but then it's almost like, it feels like it's almost more Jimmy's fault that this happened than Craig's.
Yeah, which is so weird. Yeah.
Which isn't quite right.
Which isn't quite right. Yeah. But yeah, like, I mean, even like right down to the last, you know, the reason that everything kind of, well, that last kind of interesting murder sort of situation. Yeah, I mean, it is a really interesting thing. It's almost like,
if you did a Fight Club on me and I found out that Jimmy was crack, I wouldn't be totally surprised. You know what I mean? Like, there does seem to be...
Oh, right, yeah.
Because I don't think Jimmy ever... I don't think Snowman ever blames crack, does he? You know, it's a complicated kind of relationship that he has with him.
Yeah, he doesn't seem too kind of, too morally upset actually by the whole thing at all.
Yeah,
really. It's kind of like he's kind of accepted it and just trying to survive in some weird way.
Which again is just shows the masterfulness of having that story in the present, because I mean, realistically, I guess the problem. I was saying this to Daniel as well. Like, I just love the idea of how the tiny cut on the foot becomes a problem, and no water becomes a problem, and the sunshine, the heat is such a problem, and the dampness is such a problem, and the crazy genetically engineered animals are such a problem. But yeah. You almost see that there's not a lot of power to change now, except in the moment or something. I don't know. Like, it's really weird.
Yeah.
Do you, like, as someone who, I was wondering about the setting of the novel and the way that the world is kind of rendered, and I was thinking about you as a person who spends a lot of time kind of outdoors. Did you find it quite, like, did you find that part of it, sort of like the survival in the outside, did you find that relatively compelling or truthful?
I did find the stuff that's set in the present more compelling than his flashbacks, to be honest. Mm. And I think it was because, it was not set in this kind of manicured world, which seemed really unreal to me. Like, it wasn't as immediate as, like, the tree he was living in and the beach and... I could just like visualize it instantly, and I really wanted to be in that world more, I think, than in the novel. Like, I think I kind of understand why there's so much flashback, but at the same time, I also enjoyed the actual present moment stuff more. Maybe that is more to do because he is kind of living in more of a wild kind of place, and it's a little more unpredictable or something. And just a bit more interesting, I suppose. Yeah, and I guess a bit less neat and messier, which I guess is kind of what nature is like compared to, a city or something.
So in this, I totally agree. Like, I do feel like the past land is very shiny, and the pleb lands are kind of, they seem scary, but they seem scary for human reasons. But there is something really nice about pitting someone against... the elements. Something way more interesting about this, because to me, because you are dealing with something not human, like the animals that come for him for one reason, the food issue, the bacteria, and it's just like the whole place is out to get him in a way, eh?
Yeah, it's a much, much simpler narrative, because he has one goal, right, which is to survive, and there's all these potential hazards and out there, and any of them, like a cut on the foot, can become a thing, so you're always watching out for what's coming next, and you're always waiting, so that's quite a satisfying thing to read, I think.
And there's that weird thing with the time as well, like the present, if you took out the present narrative from the flashbacks, that takes place sort of over a couple of days, doesn't it? Maybe weeks, but then like the flashbacks are sort of years worth of building up, weird.
Yeah.
How, I was just wondering, I don't know if you remember this, because I was desperately looking through this morning, my memory, which may not be right, although I can see some italics, is that some of these flashbacks seem to be prompted by a voice that appears, possibly from inside his head.
There's definitely lots of voices in his head, yep.
Yeah, and I really liked that idea. Like, at one point he sort of says that's Oryx talking to him.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, this movement in and out of flashback, although sometimes it's just a hard, section break and we're in flashback, but it feels seamless to me. Did you find it quite a seamless move?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the way she transitions between all those things is really, really, really well done. Like, I couldn't none of it felt jarring to me at all. Having a voice inside his head, which could be really annoying,
yeah.
It could be a really cheap trick or something. It felt just based on his character, and it's actually because it's set up in some of the flashback too, that, you know, he is haunted by these people. I think it's like feels really logical that Oryx would actually, he would actually hear her voice really clearly, and his, I think his mother talks to him too, doesn't she?
Mm.
She's like the kind of the wise one, and Oryx is the kind of one trying to, yeah, trying to provoke him all the time. But yeah, it's, I guess that's, and it really what does tie into that kind of ghost of the past thing. Like his mother and Oryx both seem really like ghosts, basically. They're almost not real characters. They just, they're in the flashbacks at certain points, but then for most of it, there's sort of someone he's seen on a TV screen, or his mother. Yeah, actually, people he sees them on TV a lot, like his mother as well. They're not sort of real people. They're just sort of echoes of something. The Oryx is, I guess, someone he hadn't met at that point, but he'd seen her in various things.
Yeah.
And his mum, yeah, he'd lost her, but then she was, she kept popping up and on TV news items, I think. So it's like, yeah, it's quite interesting. Like these two people are like kind of ghosts in his life, I think, and they keep haunting him right up till the end, I suppose, or the very end of the book, actually.
And that's what I think is so interesting about this. Again, going back to your fantastic reading, I'm a bit stuck on it now. But when we do meet Oryx in the past, like when she arrives, her dialogue is so odd. Like it is just so, it's so strange because she tells a story of her past as well. Yeah. You know, like we don't get to see the story of her past. We hear her tell the story of her past and how she got to be where she was and all that sort of thing. And then we get to hear her tell Jimmy the story of why she's sleeping with Craig as well as sleeping with him. And, you know, there's all this real opaqueness, I think is such a good term. And almost in a way, she still feels like a bit of a television screen when we get her in real fleshy.
Yeah,
you know,
she's quite false, eh? Like, you don't really quite believe what she's saying, even when she confirms that, yeah, he is the girl that he saw years ago. But you still don't really quite know if it's true or not, or whether she's just fabricating something to make him happy, you know. It's like really, as I found that really interesting as well. But yeah, it makes her as a character, I think, quite almost not a quite difficult to kind of, I guess you don't ever get inside her head, I suppose, so that's part of it. So she does remain quite remote from the whole thing.
And there's that cool thing that because she's become, you know, like in the stories that he's telling to the Krakers, you know, she has become like this weird god-like kind of, and I just love the idea that is mashing up with the reminiscence, you know what I mean? Like yeah. That she needs to remain opaque in the memories, because if she becomes, you know, a real human being, then is it going to make, you know, is he sort of getting muddled, you know? Like I really like the idea that, you know, like you do, I totally agree with what you're saying. Like, I mean, when I read it, I got quite angry at Margaret Atwood. Like, I was thinking, this is not, you know, because Oryx has a dreadful past, she's been exploited sexually, she's been abused, it's just awful from a very young age. It's sort of talking a little bit about capitalism and talking about all sorts of just hideous stuff. And when she comes along, she just seems so, odd about it and resolved to it and grateful almost. And I think that this is a really good idea. Like if we think of Jimmy's mind as this muddle of guilt and hunger and heat and you know, lust and regret, and then it does really, because you're so right, like we don't ever see her, we're hearing everything through Jimmy's memories and Jimmy's dreams and Jimmy's voices and stuff. It's so interesting. The way that we're moving in between, you know, these, I don't know what to call them. I think I wrote to you. I don't know whether to call them different realities or different states of being or how to call them. I was just thinking that, and I was just wondering, this is probably a dumb thing. I just wonder if memory works differently in poetry than what it does in a novel. Like, it's probably a silly question because there's so many ranges of novels and so many ranges of poetry and it crosses over. But did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is. I did think a little bit about that when you mentioned that. But essentially, I guess memory works the same, really, and on some level. I think the thing that's different in poetry is you often don't have that kind of structure of prose to, like, and the way to signal when things are memory and when things are in the moment, I guess. In some ways, a lot of poetry is all set in the past, and it's all kind of, it's sort of framed as some kind of memory, but it tends to switch back, doesn't tend to switch back and forth as much, generally. I mean, people do that as well, but it can get quite confusing if you don't do it very well, I think. So yeah, I think it tends to be less of a conscious and obvious thing that's happening. It's more like the poem's called Memory of blah blah blah, and it's a memory, or it's something that's much more immediate, or it's very rarely sort of switches back and forth like prose does as a matter of course, I think.
Because
so that's the major difference I can think of. But essentially, if you're doing something with memory, you're kind of doing the same thing in a lot of ways, I think.
Because that's what I'm kind of interested in, a bit obsessed with at the moment, is that idea of memory as a construct. You know, the fact that I always used to think that memory was like a sort of little film that we'd taken at the time, and it remains in a little glass box, and we carry it around, and we think, oh, I would like to think about that ice cream, and then it would come back to us. But I guess, you know, what I understand, which may not be correct, is that we actually make up the memory each time we remember it, you know. Each time we remember it, we're retelling it.
Yeah.
And I guess that, you know, maybe that is more apparent in, you know, maybe that is that like you say, like there are the signals in fiction that we can use, there are the signals in prose, whereas, you know, if a poem kind of did that, the payoff wouldn't be as huge, would it? Because unless you wrote at the start of every line 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't know.
Yeah, and you'd probably, if I mean, to do that, you'd probably be getting into like quite some quite long poem potentially.
Yes,
to true. Be able to handle that, and then you're getting closer to prose maybe.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, I mean, there's lots of poets that deal with that kind of versions of your own versions of history, and I guess the one thing that poetry might be able to do is use language to kind of illuminate that. So I guess you could have the same memory with different language to like show that it's sort of different. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a thing to sort of play with memory, I suppose. But yeah, it's much harder to, in the same way that a novel, I think, can switch back and forth and use that as a thing to show what's happening. I think that's definitely much harder in a poem.
Yeah, yeah. Man, that's so interesting. Is it possible that we've found a reason for the novel? I always have this thing where I just think, I guess it's because I started writing poetry. I always think, why would we write it all out? Why would we not just write the proper bits out? Yeah, anyway, I'll have people.
It'd be pretty hard to write this novel as a poem.
yes, I think we've found a reason. It wouldn't
quite be the same.
Yeah. It would not. Hey, so there were around about 3 years, am I right? Sort of 3 years difference between you reading this for the first time and reading it for this time.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, do you think this book has anything, like, does it reverberate in any way with the present moment? Like, I know it uses genetic engineering as its sort of big bad, you know, genetic engineering kills everything, and that doesn't totally feel like, it doesn't feel as scary as it did when the book came out. Maybe because there's more terrifying things, like there's plastic in the sea and all that. But the stuff on capitalism and stuff as well, you know, it's quite interesting. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
And I think it's still, not that much changes in the history of humanity in 3 years, generally. Well, I guess actually the last 3 years, a lot of
change. 3 years been a bit shit.
But I think in the overall thing, like, yeah, I would say it's still, yeah, that even though the technology has changed a lot, and there's lots of stuff in there which, and I think it's I always find it actually quite annoying in science fiction or speculative stuff when people mention too many technology things, because it dates it really quickly. Like, she mentioned CD-ROMs in there. It's like, I just can't get past it. Oh, that sticks out like a sore thumb. If you just said some other word that's not CD-ROM, like, you know, anything really, it wouldn't date it quite so badly. And I think genetic modification, I mean, it hasn't stopped happening, but it's definitely not, doesn't seem to be the same political issue that it was 5-10 years ago. I guess it's still a thing, but for me though, that the actual overarching concept of it, which is that people blindly trusting in science and like not, there's no kind of control over it, and also how that increasing division between the haves and have nots, basically, it's still definitely a thing. And I've just been reading this book called Homo Deus, which is like this. Have you read that?
No.
It's a non-fiction book written by this historian guy, I think, and it's all about like sort of humanism, you know, how humans moving away from God and becoming their own God sort of thing. Yep. And like, but then he's also like trying to figure out what's going to happen in the 21st century with humanity, and he's talks about like, you know, immortality and all these things. That it's really like really interesting stuff, but it's definitely basically the overarching principle was the same stuff that Atwood was driving at, I think, around, you know, us becoming a little bit cocky about our own abilities, I think, and thinking of us as separate species from, you know, animals and the rest of kind of the world, which, yeah, is definitely seems to be still a thing, is what I can tell.
And there's something to be said. I was just thinking when you were saying that thing about immortality, like, I keep reading these stories about 120-year-old people, 130-year-old people, 170-year-old people. Well, not 170, that's ridiculous. But, you know, like, there does seem to be the way that Crake perfects the human body in these genetically engineered Krakers, you know, like, and the children of Crake, like, the way that he sort of says, this is wrong, let's get rid of it, blah, 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 blah. There does seem to be, I think you're right, like, there does seem to be still this idea that, you know, like, if we can cure us of this or cure us of that, or if we can, you know, like, and yet, you know, this seems to be for this echelon of very rich people that can manage to do this, and the rest of us are going to be, you know, just stumbling around in the swamp, kind of,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And just this idea, yeah, like, I think you're right. Like, those were the things that spoke to me. Like, I totally agree. Like, the capitalism story, for some reason, like, what I felt like it had dated a little bit, the idea that if we use science to make money, that's not right, you know. And I felt like, yeah, I get it. But there was something to be said about, yeah, there was definitely something felt quite prescient in it. You know, prescient, that's not the right word. Something felt quite contemporary in it, you know, like it felt quite, and I can't work out what that was. And I think it may be, I feel a lot closer to the end of the world than that. I think it was the stuff in the present moment, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's that, yeah, it is that really, that the, you know, fascination with the new and the latest thing. Like, that's like, that has become way more of a thing, you know.
Yeah.
The way that people will, like, throw their phones out after 6 months and buy the newest one. It's like, you know, that's an unsustainable sort of way of being, I think. And it's, yeah, that seems to be that, you know, this book is just like at some earlier part of that journey, but it's definitely still happening, I think.
Yeah, like that thing where I often think that, I just think, how much do we need? I spend a lot of time thinking that, like, you know, it's just like, how much choice do I need, and how much, yeah, it really seems to tap into that for me. And also, I mean, I guess the terrifying thing for me is that maybe the big bad of genetic modification has slipped away, but this book, you know, the end seems very warm and very, you know, like, very damp and very stormy, and, you know, that just keeps charging on, you know, if you think, yeah, right back to Ballard with Drowned World, you know, that, you know, this idea that everything's getting warmer, you know, the end is going to be this sticky, stormy mess, you know, there's something really, oh god,
yeah, yeah,
that was hard to take.
She touches on quite a few different things, eh? There's like social, economic and environmental stuff all in this, which is quite a lot to take on at one. Usually people just pick on one thing for an apocalypse. It's not a combination of all everything, which I guess is probably actually how it would actually happen. But, yeah.
Because that's what I found really interesting when I read it, is that it was a relatively quick read for me. Like, it's very, you know, it's compelling, and the way the language works is not complex, and, you know, like, it works. Yet when I started thinking about you and me talking, I was realizing how many different layers there were, you know, like, and like you say, like, when you think about Oryx's story, was one of the things I found most compelling in it. But, you know, this idea of living in a village, I think she's in Indonesia, sort of being grabbed away because the parents need to sell a child, you know, all this sort of stuff. And all of that just, the whole that I found more compelling, I think, than the I just keep looking at the chicken knobs, you know, than the, you know, let's make a chicken with all breast, yeah. you know, so that we can sell more chicken.
Yeah.
You know, there was something about that that I just found so compelling. And
is that because I was gonna ask you as well, actually, like, it seems like a lot of that, yeah, the chicken knobs stuff, I mean, it's real satire. It's like, it's not like we're not supposed to believe that that's what would actually happen. Like, you know, I think we'd be like, oh, actually, someone would come up with a better name for chicken knobs. You wouldn't sell something like that called chicken knobs. But then, yes, but then aspects of it seem quite real, like Oryx, you know, like that does happen. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
So it was a weird, I found it quite a weird combination of satire and realism. Like, and in some ways, I kind of found that a little bit jarring. Like, and that's kind of what I think made me wonder whether Jimmy was making up some of the stuff, because it's like, how could you be in such a stark realist world where it's hot and oppressive, and but then you're like, but then the world you just came from seems like almost like a comic thing. I don't know. But yeah, I found that like a weird combination of satire and realism. I don't know. And you know, I kind of felt the same way. Like, I was more interested in the bits that did seem really real. Like, yeah, Oryx's background, even though it's really not, it's only sort of touched upon a little bit.
And I think there's something, I totally agree. Like, I feel like there is something of satire in it, and there is this mismatch of tone, which, you know, I think I quite liked it. Liked that we moved from the ridiculous to the horrific, you know, like, but it is really interesting to think that chicky knobs, so this is the idea is that we're picking on chicky knobs, but the idea is that they've I think I'm right, they've got a chicken, they've genetically engineered it so all it is breast, there's no wings, no feet, no brain,
something like that, yeah.
They feed it through a tube, yeah. I mean, oh god, it's making me sick just thinking about it. But this is what's interesting about that, is that that sits on the same continuum as these amazing creatures that Craig has made, you know, that are not warlike, are protected from ultraviolet rays, have this, you know, there's no aggression in the sexual drive. There's just, you know, like these amazing, I don't know, I really like them.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is something of interest there, but I totally agree. Like, and I don't know if that's a dating thing. Like, I don't know if this would have felt really fresh in 2003. And it's interesting because I think that I really like Infinite Jest, and in that there is a little bit of this kind of stuff going on, but there's something, there's a poignancy and a sadness every time it's mentioned that I don't think there is in here. You know, like, Jimmy kind of watches it all happening and just thinks, oh, that's weird, you know, but yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's that thing, I can imagine someone sort of defending it and saying, oh, that's what we do, you know, but it just, I wonder if it's just a bridge too far, you know, like, I mean, what do? We, you know, kill chickens and kill bobby calves and, you know, like, I mean, that's not really genetic engineering, though, is it?
But well, that's the whole point of satire, right? Is to, like, make those things that we have accepted as, okay, well, maybe not that great, but we've accepted it and take it to some extreme where it's like, actually, that's really wrong. That's the whole point of satire. But I guess, and actually, maybe when she was writing about, you know, child slavery pornography, and maybe she felt she didn't need to satirize it.
It's like,
that's just horrific on any level.
So bad, yeah. Yeah.
And
I think it would be really interesting to go through and look at the language that's around the because also in that, in what you read, there's the Bliss Plus Pool as well, which is this, there's some weirdness around that as well. I just think it's so interesting. And yet, again, it may just be a CD-ROM moment. You know, that's the other thing, is it may just be, you know, like, maybe sex slavery has not gone away, but this idea, you know, maybe if the food industry had carried on at the same rate, you know, we would be at this point reading this in 2017 and saying, oh yes, I too, although, you know,
I think it's not much, I don't think that much has changed in the whole food thing. I mean, you know, it's probably just become more of a thing, if anything, so.
Although
I just think she had to use satire because I think people are so complacent about whole food thing, you know, and they just don't think about it, I guess, because it's such a thing that people need to do every day. It's like, you just accept it.
I think you did right. I think you did right. I think food is one of those interesting places where, because I mean, I've been reading article after article on our vegan Facebook page about you know, new meats. You know, someone's making meat without meat. You know, and everyone's like, hurrah! And I'm like, I don't think I want to eat that. But you know, like the, I mean, it, I think that we are a weird kind of lobster in a slowly boiling pot when it comes to food. In a way that I'm not sure, I don't know, there's something, oh, we could eat a lobster. But I do think you're right. I think it's interesting that it's the food bits that are there.
Yeah.
Hey, I was also going to talk to you a little bit about the end of the novel.
I was hoping you weren't going to do that.
Oh, really?
No, that's cool.
We don't have to.
No, that's cool. It's just because it's pretty open-ended, I guess.
So yeah. I haven't read the other three novels, of course. So yeah. I'm like this loser.
Is there another three or two?
Oh, two. Another two. Yeah, sorry. But were you happy to find more people? Spoiler alert, he comes across some people.
Yeah, might want to turn off now.
Yeah,
stop. Well, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. There's four paragraphs. And it does really feel like possibly someone said put that in so people will write the right next book, but
I actually really like the ending, and I guess maybe it's the kind of creative writing course to me. I'm like, oh, I'm okay with like ambiguous endings.
Yeah,
I can imagine it would annoy a hell of a lot of people.
Yeah,
because it's like the one moment of hope he has in the entire novel. And it's really funny, there is a few paragraphs, but he really struggles to imagine like what hope would look like. He's like, I think he wants to whack them with a stick or something.
Yeah.
He just can't deal with it. He's like, okay, I've been sitting around thinking about myself for like 3 weeks now. There's a potential future, but he doesn't seem to know what to do with it. And I think that's kind of the point. It's like, he was the completely wrong person to be saving humanity after an apocalypse, and I think that's the kind of point of it. Like, he just can't deal with the future. So I think that, and so we shouldn't get the future either. Although I was kind of disappointed to read that there is a future in two more novels. It's kind of, you can't really end it like that and then write a sequel. I don't know. Maybe you can.
I totally agree. And like, I was just looking at those last two sentences. Like, he goes through this big thing of, will I kill them? Well, do they want to kill me? Are they friends? Blah, you know, blah. And then the last line, you see, I totally read this differently when I read it. 0 hour, snowman thinks, time to go. And I was thinking that go towards the people, but it almost sounds like it's time to, now there are some people, I better get out of here. You know, which I quite like. I really like this idea because, like, I mean, Craik hasn't left him there to look after humanity, has he? He's left him there. You know, Craik has got rid of humans.
Why did he leave him there?
Do you want to hear my theory? My theory is quite boring. I think Craik left him there because, like, I don't know why he didn't leave Oryx, but I don't think he could handle the idea of Oryx and him together. Craik wanted to take Oryx with him.
Yeah.
But I think that there's something about Jimmy that, and he talks about it, he alludes to it, you know, like, Jimmy may be more, he's less scientific, he's more a bit fuzzy in his thinking, and somehow he feels that he's the person to look after the Krakers and to let them sort of make the world, you know, like re-inhabit the world. But it's such a great idea, like this idea that you would leave sort of the wrong person, you know. Like, you know, I mean, what does Jimmy have to give? You know, like, he doesn't understand science. He's a bit of a waste, you know. Like, I mean, you know, and I just love this idea that really the most important thing that he has is his imagination and the stories that he tells. And
but maybe, yeah, maybe Craik, I mean, because it also is quite interesting that Craik seems like a way more intelligent person throughout the end. So it's almost like he's like using Jimmy since he was 14, you know, to some end goal. Like, it kind of feels like that sometimes. So you do kind of wonder what was his master plan all along. And maybe he knew he was going to be that kind of like the storyteller for the Krakers, to like give them some kind of mythology to build their new like society around or something. But so then in Craik's mind, he was the right person to do that, where if you left some scientists, he'd try and modify them a bit or something, or try and resurrect humanity. You know, maybe New Jimmy would just give up on humanity.
Yeah, I really like that idea of what's that thing called in, like, you know, in work how they say you rise to the level of your incompetence. You know, you get someone who's the manager, and then, you know, because they can't, you know what I mean, like they can't go any further.
Yeah.
So they're sort of at a point. I really like that idea.
Yeah, leave someone in charge who's not that great.
Yeah, which is so great because there is that interesting thing where Oryx is trying to teach them almost to be human, you know, but it's like, no, we don't want a mother, we want, you know, we want this guy.
Yeah,
it's just so great.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that end, I'm the same as you, like this end did not make me want to read the other two. Like I didn't think to myself, oh, I must find out what happens. I actually loved the idea that I was going to leave Jimmy on the beach with all these new problems, with this thing that looked like a solution, you know, this thing that, you know. And just, I must admit as well, because I'm a bit of a misanthrope, maybe, I was thinking, oh, other people, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You're kind of hoping the Krakers just take over, right?
Yeah, yeah. I totally agree. So I'm just having a look through to see if we've missed anything. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
It'll probably come to me in about half an hour.
Yeah, Spirit of the Staircase. I must admit, when we were just talking about that hideousness and the immediacy of the outbreak is so well rendered. Like, it's just, I recently watched a movie, it might have been Arrival, it was one of those, is that movie about those spaceships that arrive? Anyway.
Yeah.
Like,
the weird things that just levitate.
Yeah. I so like that movie. But like, I really liked the way people just kept dropping off, you know, and everybody, and Jimmy was kind of like, oh shit, I know what's going on. I don't want to know what's going on. And then just that wonderful, and then something clicks in with Jimmy and he does exactly what Craig tells him to do.
Yeah.
You know, he keeps the people out of the safe place. It's just such a great sort of masterclass of character.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing character. Like, I think that's, for me, that's the key to the whole thing, is like the character of Jimmy, and that, yeah, he's the complete opposite of anyone I've ever read in that kind of type of novel before, I think. Like, I always compare it to like The Road, you know, which is the other great post-apocalyptic novel, which is like the complete opposite of this in almost every way. And the characters, yeah, obviously, like, that's all about looking for that. It's just hope. Their hope is, like, eternal, you know?
Mm.
And this is the complete opposite. He just has no hope whatsoever. He's just trapped in the past. Yeah. Mm.
And also that idea of, like, that new, what do they call it? Competency porn. You know, like, that idea that, you know, I was just thinking about people like the guy from The Martian and, you know, lots of people that are caught in their survival issues, and even The Road, like, there seems to be some definite understanding of what needs to happen and how to do it and that sort of thing. And although Jimmy, you know, that's right, he drinks as well. That's the other thing. Like, there's no water, so he drinks something that dehydrates him. Yeah. You know, he spends a lot of time drunk.
Yeah.
And, yeah, just this idea that, you know, he is at a point where he's thinking there could be no food, you know, like the mango is not going to keep him alive.
Mm.
Oh, it's just such a wonderful book.
It's like, this is just like what would actually happen if there was one person left on Earth, I think.
Yeah.
They wouldn't, like, be striving for some survival, I think, you know, more than likely they would just become really hopeless.
Because that's the thing I wonder, like, I always think I have no survival urge whatsoever. I'm really worried that if I was in a situation I'd just give up or kill myself.
You can probably stop worrying now, because, yeah, it's probably, you can.
Yeah, I could be the Jimmy of my own destiny. It shows
it's that okay.
It's okay.
You don't have to save the planet.
It'll be wicked. Hey, thanks, Bill.
No worries.
That was awesome. I really enjoyed talking to you about that.
Thank you.
I'll just record and then I'll give us a minute and then we'll do it.
So you're doing an Oryx and Crake series.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I did Daniel the other day. And then I'm doing Antonia Bale, who's a short story writer, and I think William's going to do one as well.
Cool.
So yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. It's weird because I'm really worried that I'm going to totally contradict myself.
Probably.
Because, you know, like, Daniel says things and I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then William says things and I'm like, yeah, yeah. It's really weird.